7 past the hour, time for the Malloy program. Hi, welcome to our little meeting here. My name is Mike Malloy. Thanks for tuning in. We have quite a few things to cover this evening, including, I want to start, how many of you know who George Polk was? George Polk. He was a CBS reporter who was covering the right-wing revolution in Greece back in 1948, and he was murdered by the CIA. That's the common knowledge. He was murdered by the CIA. The CIA then lost documents concerning its investigation of the murder of George Polk, and it also destroyed, the CIA destroyed his file on the Freedom of Information Act requests for Polk documents. In June of 2006, the United States Archives asked the CIA and the National Archives to investigate the possibility the CIA had lost or destroyed records of the Polk case. If you're familiar with George Polk, you know what I'm talking about. He was an American reporter that was murdered. I state right up front that I think he was murdered by the CIA because he was reporting too much truth. Where it concerned the right wing attempted to take over after World War II, when Greece, there was a question whether Greece was going to go communist or stay in the hands of the military dictatorship. And if you know anything about post-World War II history in Greece, you know that it stayed in the hands of the military dictatorship thanks to the CIA. Polk was reporting stuff for CBS that the CIA didn't want revealed. He was murdered. His brother is William R. Polk. He's a veteran foreign policy consultant. He's an author. Actually, both the brothers were relations to President James K. Polk. William Polk, who I'm talking about now, is also the foreign policy advisor for Democratic candidate Dennis Kucinich's presidential campaign. If you want to know more about William R. Polk, just do a Wikipedia search on this man, and you will be absolutely and utterly blown away. I think he's probably in his 80s at this point. He or some member of his family, going all the way back to the 18th century, it's almost like what was that character, Kathy, that Woody Allen played, who showed up everywhere? Zelig. I knew it would pop out. This guy is like Zelig. He's been every place where there was anything to do with U.S. foreign policy for the past, I don't know, pick a number, 60 years? It's incredible. Well, he's written an open letter to Barack Obama regarding our involvement in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I want to share this letter with you because it is very coherent where it concerns what we're facing there. And I just wish that Barack Obama would read this. Dear Mr. President, although we were separated by more than a decade, we lived a few steps apart in Hyde Park in Chicago. We were both professors at the University of Chicago. There I established the Center for Middle Eastern Studies and was also president of the Adlai Stevenson Institute of International Affairs before going to Chicago during the Kennedy administration. I was the member of the Policy Planning Council responsible for the Middle East and Central Asia. A Democrat, I was an early supporter of yours. So I hope you will accept the following analysis and proposals as being from a friend, as well as a person with considerable experience on Afghanistan and Pakistan. In recent events, I see an opportunity to accomplish American objectives while avoiding a course of action that could derail plans for your presidency, just as the Vietnam War ruined the presidency of Lyndon Johnson. According to press accounts, you're being told that America can win the war against the Taliban by employing overwhelming military power. Just like President Johnson's generals, yours keep asking for more troops. You're also being told that we can multiply our power with counterinsurgency tactics. Having made a detailed study, laid out in my book, Violent Politics, a detailed study of a dozen insurgencies ranging from the American Revolution to Afghanistan, and fought by the British, the French, the Germans, and Russians in America, Europe, Asia, and Africa, I doubt that you are being well advised. When I was in government, we were told we could achieve victory in Vietnam by the same combination of force and counterinsurgency recommended by your advisors in Afghanistan. But as the editors of the Pentagon Papers concluded, quote, the attempt to translate the newly articulated theory of counterinsurgency into operational reality through a mixture of military, social, psychological, economic, and political measures, they were marked by consistency in results as well as in techniques. All failed dismally. End quote. Pentagon Papers. What actually brought all the insurgencies, including the one in Vietnam, to a halt was the withdrawal of the foreigners. Some foreigners left in defeat, but others left in ways that achieved their most important objectives. I believe you have an opportunity to achieve America's important objectives in Afghanistan. In Vietnam, we never understood the Vietnamese and were defeated. So here I lay out the essential features of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Kashmir, and then show how they set the context for a successful policy. I begin with Pakistan. Pakistan has long been obsessed with Kashmir, frightened of India, and favorably inclined toward its Pashtun ethnic minority. To help Pashtun freedom fighters, so-called, in the 1979-89 war against the Soviet Union, we funneled billions of dollars into Pakistan. Opposition to the Soviet Union was our motivation, but Pakistan had a different motivation: to protect Islam. This necessarily involved it not only in Afghanistan, but also in Kashmir. Since Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, is about as close to the Indian-held capital of Kashmir, Srinagar, and to the Khyber Pass, which leads into Afghanistan, as New York is to Hartford, Connecticut, both Afghanistan and Kashmir appear to the Pakistanis to be nearly domestic issues. Kashmir is one of those legacies of the age of imperialism that still blight international relations. Today's problem was created in 1846 when the British sold Kashmir and its Muslim population to a Hindu who became its Maharaja. Cruel and rapacious, he and his descendants were bitterly hated by Kashmiris. When the British were leaving South Asia in 1947, they assumed that because the people were mainly Muslim, Kashmir would be folded into what became Pakistan. But the Maharaja opted for India. Despite a promise from Nehru, then Prime Minister Designate of India, to Lord Louis Mountbatten, then Viceroy of India, that a plebiscite would be held to ascertain the wishes of the Kashmiris, it was never held. Ever since, the Indians have occupied Kashmir with 500,000 troops as a conquered enemy country. Under Indian rule, thousands of Kashmiris have been imprisoned, hundreds disappeared, and almost everyone afflicted by lesser tyrannies. In shorthand terms, Kashmir is the Palestine of Central and South Asia. Pakistan and India have fought three wars and innumerable bloody engagements over Kashmir. The drain on the resources of both India and Pakistan have been immense, in part because of the destabilizing effect of this conflict. Pakistan has never developed a durable, coherent government. The only really solid Pakistani organization is the army. Civilian governments have been marked by massive corruption, ineptitude, and fragility. There are many reasons for Pakistan's problems, but one stands out. It is an amalgam of ethnic, cultural nations. The British ruled the Punjab and the Sindh directly, but sought merely to divide and weaken the Pashtuns. That was the purpose of the so-called Durand Line, which they drew in 1893 along the mountainous frontier. The effect of the line is that today about 25 million Pashtuns live in Pakistan, and roughly 14 million live in Afghanistan. The Pashtuns wanted to form an independent nation state in 1947, but were prevented from doing so. Until its recent military campaign against the Taliban, the Pakistanis made little attempt to integrate the Pashtuns, but because of them, Pakistan has always been deeply affected by Afghanistan. Right after the break, we'll pick this up. Past the hour, open letter from William R. Polk to Barack Obama, continuing. Afghanistan has always baffled foreign invaders. After three attempts from 1842 to 1919 to rule it, the British gave up. At the end of a decade of costly war, the Russians did as well. Neither understood the complex social and political makeup of the country. Without doing so, we cannot hope to accomplish our objectives, so let me highlight the main points. When I first went to Afghanistan in 1962 to prepare a U.S. national policy paper, I found a good analogy for the land and the society to be a rocky hill sliced by gullies and covered by 20,000 ping pong balls. The balls represented the autonomous village states, politically and economically divided. They shared a common adherence to a blend of primitive Islam and even more primitive tribal customs. During their occupation, the Russians crushed many ping pong balls, but they could not defeat enough of them to win. At any given time, roughly 80% of the country remained outside Russian control. So the Russians won all the battles, but lost the war. Afghanistan became the graveyard of the Soviet Union. The brutal Soviet occupation shattered the Afghan social structure. Nearly 1 in 10 Afghans was killed or died, and more than 5 million fled the country. Living wretchedly in refugee camps, mainly in Pakistan, hundreds of thousands of young Afghan men were reshaped. Like the biblical children of Israel after 40 years in the wilderness, these Afghans emerged very different from their fathers. The new generation kept their stern code of belief, but they lost touch with the humanizing aspects of growing up in families. Living apart from mothers and sisters, many of the young men, mostly Pashtuns, were incorporated into male-only madrasas, in which they were housed, fed, armed, and radicalized. They emerged as the foot soldiers of the Taliban. When they were in power, the Taliban enforced an ugly, repressive regime, but it was no worse than some other regimes in Asia and Africa. And, as we can observe, societies and regimes evolve. Look at what has happened in post-war Vietnam. No one in my time in government could have guessed that the communist regime would evolve into a relatively open and, indeed, capitalistic society. In Afghanistan, there were signs, still faint to be sure, that while the stern code remains intact, at least the Taliban leadership is beginning to modify its program. As I will point out, we can encourage this trend. But as insurgents, the Taliban remain formidable foes. Our chances of defeating them are poor. Indeed, some independent observers believe they are becoming more popular while we are becoming less popular. They and many non-Taliban Afghans regard us, as they regarded the Russians, as foreign anti-Muslim invaders. Moreover, they see that the government we are backing is corrupt and rapacious. Observers report that it is deeply involved in the drug trade, stealing aid money, and even selling U.S.-supplied arms to the Taliban, as the South Vietnamese government did to the Viet Cong. Moreover, it is ineffective. Its writ hardly runs outside Kabul. most of the country is in the hands of brutal, predatory warlords. The government of Hamid Karzai will not last long after our withdrawal. That was the fate of the Soviet puppet government there and of our puppet government in Saigon. Forced to choose between the warlords and the Taliban, Afghans are likely to choose the Taliban. As General Stanley McChrystal has said, quote, key groups have become nostalgic for the security and justice Taliban rule provided, end quote. Thus, we are courting long-term strategic defeat. Even in the tactical short run, I believe, trying to defeat the Taliban is not in America's interest. The harder we try, the more likely terrorism will be to increase and spread. As the history of every insurgency demonstrates, the more foreign boots there are on the ground, and the harder the foreigners fight, the more hatred they engender. Substituting drone attacks for ground combat is no solution. Having been bombed from the air, I can attest that it is more infuriating than a ground attack. Our principal objection to the Taliban is that it has given Osama bin Laden and his immediate entourage a base of operations. The two groups, however, are very different. The Taliban are a national political organization anchored in Afghanistan's largest ethnic group, while Al-Qaeda is a loose alliance of dissidents from many countries, united only in their belief that their legitimate aims of ethnic national self-determination and religious culture are being denied. For us, the overlap of the two groups comes when we try to get the Taliban to surrender Osama. We have offered what to poor tribesmen is an astronomical reward for him, dead or alive. This ploy has failed. In the Afghan code of Pashtunwali, to fail to protect someone who has been given sanctuary is a mortal sin. So our attempts to get the Pashtuns to do this insults their sense of honor. More when we come back after the break.
Dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
26 before the hour, an open letter from foreign policy expert and consultant and the foreign policy advisor for Denis Kucinich's presidential campaign, William R. Polk. Open letter from Polk to President Obama about how to handle Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Kashmir. Continuing. So what, Mr. President, realistically can we do and what can we not do? Let me be specific. On the nuclear issue, Pakistan and India are locked together. The only effective course of action is precisely the one you've recommended. Reduction of nuclear weapons everywhere, beginning with us and the Russians. Once momentum is established, we should be able to move toward regional arms control with security guarantees, economic incentives, and revocation of the neoconservative-inspired first strike doctrine. From having served on the Crisis Management Committee during the Cuban Missile Crisis, I can attest that nuclear weapons anywhere are a danger to people everywhere. Your policy is literally vital to us all. Regarding Al-Qaeda, what is important to U.S. security is not capturing Osama bin Laden, but disabling him. That is achievable. Here's how. He now enjoys the protection of the Pashtuns, the sacred obligation to not insult a guest. Is in effect, but the Pashtun, this order is limited. Osama's Pashtun host can insist with honor on his stopping actions that endanger them. That could be a key element in a truce that either we or preferably Pakistan makes with the Taliban. From that necessary first step, we can move toward dealing with the motivations of the disparate components of Al-Qaeda. Since terrorist attacks can be mounted from many places, the only effective long-term defense against them is to deal with their causes. On the drug trade, it would be convenient if the Afghans solved our drug problem for us. But if we are realistic, we must admit that drugs are ultimately our problem. Heroin is proof that market forces really do work. We can make minor adjustments, subsidizing the planting of other crops, buying up what is grown, engaging in defoliation, etc. But as long as people are willing to pay a high price for drugs, producers and distributors will supply them. To put our attempt to stop them in perspective, imagine a foreign invader trying to stop the French from producing wine. We cannot expect any Afghan government to solve our problem. But if we leave, the Taliban would probably again combat the drug trade as they did in the 1990s. On our occupation, we need to consider three issues. Does our presence lead toward a sustainable result after our withdrawal? Can the occupation be maintained without turning a large part of the Afghan population and others against us? And can we afford it? I think the answer to all three is no. Consider these factors. First, it is rare that insurgencies end with the establishment of a regime favored by the occupier. That was the experience of the British and Russians in Afghanistan, the Americans in Vietnam, the French in Algeria. Governments acceptable to the foreign occupier may last a short while, but almost always those who fought hardest against the foreigner take over when he leaves. Second, U.S. military intervention in Afghanistan has not only solidified the Taliban as an organization, but has also created increasing public support for it. There is much evidence in Afghanistan, as there has been in every insurgency I have studied, that foreign soldiers increase rather than calm hostility. The British found that to be true even in the American Revolution, where the two sides were cousins, so to speak, shared the same religion, and spoke the same language. Third, the cost and casualties may not rise to the level of Vietnam or even Iraq, but the financial cost is unlikely to be less. My hunch is that the real cost to the U.S. economy will be $3 to $6 trillion, calculating overall not just congressional appropriations. So the Afghan campaign could derail your plans for America, as Vietnam derailed Johnson's Great Society. On Afghan government reform, there's not much we can do. Corruption runs from top to bottom. As I witnessed in Vietnam, if a government wishes to steal itself to death, foreigners can't stop it. We had an opportunity in the 1960s to help reforming Afghan government, but failed to do so. Indeed, we welcomed the man who overthrew it, Mohammad Daoud Khan, because he was anti-communist. To be realistic, we must assume that even an elected Hamid Karzai will probably not last long after our army departs. On the Pakistani government, there's even less we can do. There also, massive corruption begins at the top. President Asif Ali Zardari, who is described as our man, is said to be disliked by the vast majority of Pakistanis and has a long record of mind-boggling dishonesty. I think Zardari's administration will be replaced fairly soon by a military government. If so, we must roll with the punch, but try modestly and unobtrusively to help encourage the growth of compensating civic institutions. On Kashmir, as with many world problems, the logical solution is probably not practical. If India and Pakistan could agree to hold a plebiscite, the Kashmiris would probably accept modestly enhanced autonomy under India. Neither Pakistan nor India wants an independent Kashmir, but the current situation is costly for both. So they have established a back channel to inch toward accommodation. We should stay out of this problem. On Islam, you have set the only intelligent, humane course for our diverse world. The legacy of the neoconservatives and the Bush administration can be overcome, but it will take time for the marvelous speech you gave in Cairo to convince Muslims that we are willing to live with them in a multicultural world. On getting started, we have been given what I think is a major new opportunity by the Pakistanis. The Taliban are, after all, Pashtuns, Muslims, and either Afghans or Pakistanis, while we are none of these. Thus, Pakistan can fight the Taliban more acceptably than we can. And because of its long-standing support of their movement, Pakistan can more easily bring the Taliban to the negotiating table. If we are smart, we will take advantage of its attack on the Taliban in Swat by backing out as quickly and as gracefully as possible. How to get out is something former Senator George McGovern and I laid out in our book, Out of Iraq, which was suitable with suitable changes can provide a template for Afghanistan. But as long as we are there, the war will continue with disastrous consequences for all the things you want to do and we Americans need you to do. We must not follow Britain and Russia into Afghan's quicksand. Respectfully yours, William R. Polk. Into Afghanistan's quicksand. Respectfully, William R. Polk. Now, this essay, this open letter, which is presented as an essay in the current issue of The Nation, I think is one that I wish there was some way for a million Americans to put it in an email and send it to Barack Obama. It's what you and I have talked about on this program over and over and over again. I think it's what any, you don't have to be a foreign policy genius to understand this stuff. You really don't. This is stuff that you and I understand, and neither of us are foreign policy geniuses, are we? But we do understand, we've talked about on this program, insurgencies. I can't think. I'm sure there must be some in history that were defeated, but I can't think of any. I'm talking about long term. I cannot think of an insurgency that has been defeated. Somebody could say, well, what about the FARC in Colombia? Well, that's been going on for what, 30 years, 40 years? It hasn't been defeated yet. The insurgency in the 13 colonies in this country, as Polk points out, we were of the same religion, the same language, the same skin color. And yet we refused to be defeated until we defeated the British. So it's insane to continue this. Now, when you have someone like Stanley McChrystal, who, and we talked about this when his report was leaked a few weeks back, McChrystal himself provides the evidence that any attempt in Afghanistan, short of, and we found out today that his number of 40,000, that was the middle number. The number really was from zero more troops to 80,000 more. What McChrystal's talking about is a massive increase in soldiers, all of whom eventually will be defeated. We had 600,000 in Vietnam, and we were defeated. And we took nearly 60,000 dead. This is what McChrystal wants, because McChrystal is a war lover. Petraeus is a war lover. So this is what Obama is up against. The neocons that control media in this country are also war lovers, while at the same time they are goddamn hideous cowards, because none of them would ever go near a combat situation. If this country was attacked, they would become like the Vichy French. They would become the collaborators with an invader. Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, the first thing that they would do if an invader hit this country would be to approach them and see if they could make a deal. They're swine. So who does that leave to try to influence Barack Obama? The official Democrats, you know, the party structure is shot full of cowardice. It's useless. Who does it leave? It leaves us. How do we do it? By sending a million emails? By taking to the streets? By refusing to accept a policy that it appears Barack Obama is going to put in place, and that is to send yet more of our people into Afghanistan to kill and be killed and maimed and wounded and destroyed? Now, God damn it, at some point, we have to do something to stop this. Because if we don't, this is going to be the final defeat of the United States. This is where the United States goes to die.
Senators and lawyers,
the quality of mercy is not saved.
Victims and heroes,
the quality of mercy is not saved.
Murderers and martyrs, the quality of mercy is not saved.
We'll be right back.
truth seekers. Here's the truth speaker, Mike Malloy.
It's 10 before the hour. Now, interestingly, the U.S. military in eastern Afghanistan has very recently, within the past couple of weeks, changed its media embed rules to ban pictures of troops killed in that war in Afghanistan. A ground rules document issued September 15th by the regional command at Bagram Airfield, Regional Command East, says, quote, media will not be allowed to photograph or record video of U.S. personnel killed in action, end quote. Now, this language is new. A version of that same document, dated a couple of months before, July 23rd, says, quote, media will not be prohibited from covering casualties as long as a series of conditions are met, end quote. Pictures of American military deaths are rare, of course, but until now they've not been officially banned during either of the ongoing wars. All of a sudden, in anticipation, one would suppose, of this buildup, this increase of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, now it becomes necessary to begin the George Bush program, of which apparently Obama is signing off on. No pictures of American casualties. We can't do this, can we? We can't do this. The truth is that I know as well as you do that stopping an escalation of our involvement in Afghanistan is almost impossible. It really is. There were 10 million people around the earth that demonstrated against our reinvasion of Iraq. It resulted in nothing. We went in anyway with shock and awe, and continued the murder and slaughter of the Iraqi people. There were millions of people, I don't believe that's an exaggeration, in this country who repeatedly demonstrated against the beginning of that war, and it did nothing. So apparently, it is apparent that the government of Bill Clinton, the government of George Walker Bush, and now the government of Barack Obama does not respond to massive street demonstrations. It simply does not. Now, of course, we don't know what would happen if 5 million Americans took to the streets, but that won't happen, will it? That's not going to happen. The war in Afghanistan is not something that anybody is really keyed in on. Well, you are, and I am, but the vast majority of people could not care less about this war. It doesn't mean anything. It's like trying to get them aroused about Israel and Palestine. Unless they are ardent American Jews, they are not going to pay any attention to it. It's like trying to get people concerned or focused on what we have done in Iraq. Nobody wants to hear this stuff. I don't want to hear it. Don't bother me. I've got a mortgage to worry about. That's certainly understandable, but of course we can't, can we? We can't draw the connection between ending our involvement in these foreign wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, most immediately, and the saving of the American economy, which means that you won't lose your house. The reason you're losing your house now, partly is because we are so involved in all this external stuff. I mean, even the framers, plus the financial services industry back here is run by gangsters. But even the framers, as flawed as they were, tried to warn about getting involved in foreign wars and treaties. You remember that? If you read the Federalist Papers, any of the writings of Jefferson, Madison, Adams, any of these people, you're aware that that was almost the primary rule. Don't get involved in foreign entanglements, foreign allegiances, foreign wars. This is insane. And we managed to maintain that until, of course, the Spanish-American War, in which case Teddy Roosevelt and the corporate America decided it's time to build empire. Well, here we are. Here we are. So it's lasted about 115 years, our empire. And if you and I want to see the death of American empire in our lifetimes, and I don't care if you're 70 or 75, it's going to happen fairly quickly. If we get involved to the degree that this crazed General McChrystal wants us to get involved, and the neocons want us to get involved, And it's not just McChrystal. Some of his cohorts, the real war lovers, the ones that like to take a look at all the graphs and charts and move things around. It's kind of like Robert McNamara did to us in the Vietnam War. Kind of like General William Westmoreland in the Vietnam War. These people are insane. McNamara admitted his insanity before he died. But in the meantime, how many millions of people had to die because of McNamara's insanity? 2 or 3 million in Indochina, 60,000 here. I mean, come on, God damn it. Are we going to do this again? The quick answer is yes. We're going to do it again. It's astonishing. Iraq was bad enough. This is Afghanistan. We will be defeated. We will be defeated in a manner that will destroy the American empire. Now, I know what you're thinking. That's a good thing. There are better ways to end American empire than this way. The best way to end American empire is to just come to the realization that it's not working. It's over. And it's time to come home. It's time to stop this. Afghanistan is going to be where this country, the United States of America, hits a brick wall at 100 miles an hour. The Afghan people, whether they're Pashtun, Taliban, whatever, will not be defeated any more than the early Americans in this country could be defeated by the mighty British Empire. They couldn't do it. We're not going to be able to do it either in Afghanistan. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Stressful.
Seven past the hour. This is the Malloy program. I really do think you should go to thenation.com and read the, at your leisure, the essay that I shared with you. Because, not essay, the open letter to Barack Obama. It is so clear. It is so concise. It gives a little bit of history, just enough. Not that Obama doesn't understand the history. I don't know what the hell is going on here. I don't know why a man as smart as Barack Obama, and he is smart, would agree to another infusion of U.S. troops, more U.S. money, more death, more destruction in an unwinnable situation. Surely he understands the history of insurgencies. Surely he understands recent U.S. history, where it concerns our adventures overseas. Surely he understands what happens when you support corrupt puppet governments. And it doesn't make any difference if they're left or right. If they are corrupt and they are puppets, they are going to fall. And we are going to fall with them. What is so hard about this? Why is this so difficult? Why do we have to sit back, not you and me, but why are the airwaves flooded with the rhetoric of pro-war, a pro-war position. We have to be in Afghanistan and fill in the blank. You know what the right-wing rhetoric is? It's going to happen again, isn't it? Only this time, this will be the last time for the United States. This is it. Just like Afghanistan, by massive coincidence, was the last stand, the last incident for the Soviet Union. This is it. So you and I will be alive in our lifetime, in other words, if you're 20 or 80, because this is going to happen fast. We will see the utter and absolute defeat of the United States. It will happen in the economic arena, and it's going to happen in the foreign policy arena, and it's going to happen in our adventurism, our imperialism. We're going to watch it all collapse. And I'm holding my breath. I hate to see this. Maybe I hate to be a part of it. I hate to see this happen in my country. I can't stand it. But it's happening right in front of us. This is a part that is so mystifying to me. It's happening right in front of us. And we're allowing it to happen. By we, us, I'm talking about our government, our 535 elected representatives, and another 3, 4, 10, 15, 20 that are policymakers in the executive branch. Here we are. 600 people are sitting there on their asses. The people with real power. You don't have any power. Neither do I. We don't have squat. But the 600 people who do have political power are letting this happen. Meanwhile, the corporate predators, they're just happy as pigs in swill because it doesn't make any difference to them. Winners, losers, matters not. The money's always there. There's money in winning wars. There's money in losing wars. There's money in building economies. There's money in collapsing economies. Come on. They don't give a goddamn. This is why, you know, the guy that called me the other night about, oh, capitalism is a wonderful thing. No, it's not. It's a horrible thing. Now, there might be temporary winners. That's what capitalism is all about. Temporary winners. And the majority of people lose. Oh, well. To give you an idea, how about a missive from Prairie 2? The Bureau of Labor Statistics, he writes, does not track pay cuts, but they do maintain an index of weekly pay for production workers, and this accounts for 80% of the workforce. That index has fallen for 9 consecutive months, weekly pay. An unprecedented string over the 44 years the Bureau has calculated weekly pay. This includes people working fewer hours, like and those whose wages have been cut. The old record was a 2-month decline during the 1981-82 recession. We've had 9 consecutive months. Some companies like Hewlett-Packard are making no secret of their policy of driving down wages. Even union jobs that still exist are cutting pay. And more insidious is the practice allowing new hires to be paid a fraction of union scale. The "I've got mine" attitude of the Reagan Democrats is alive and well. Those same workers that have now found that their pensions pay only pennies on the dollar deserve little sympathy from the new generation of workers who are getting minimum wage for the same job on the 2-tier union contract. Cuts in benefits are much harder to calculate, but the average increase in the employee's share of health insurance for next year will be 10%. In dollar amounts, this will be the biggest increase ever, despite inflation being officially at zero. Health insurance, if you get it from your employer, the premium will go up 10%, even though the cost or inflation is zero. The Dow crossed 10,000 today to wild cheering on the trading floor. It first did that 10 and a half years ago. What are they cheering about? The traders on the floor are cheering because they didn't put their 401ks in the stock market. Wall Street bankers are really cheering. They were nearing extinction a year ago and needing trillions of taxpayer dollars to stay in business. They're now reportedly lining up to receive $140 billion in executive bonuses this year. To justify these outrageous amounts, they point to Wall Street. Well, the average American's making money now, too. They say this with a straight face. The average American lost a third of his wealth in the past year. Tens of the millions are completely broke. And nobody is even talking about that changing. In reality, we could simply pay these parasites this money and not miss it, if in return they would keep their paws off of our economy. An old-fashioned protection racket is what they're running. But no, we paid them, and still they smash the front windows of the store. We need a better class of gangster in our neighborhood. Oh, this just in. Goldman Sachs is forecasting that oil will top $85 a barrel by the end of the year. How do they know? They own a lot of oil. And if you don't want to sit in the cold this winter, you will pay. By the way, if you don't like it, there's got to be some nice windows you got out front. Eh? Pray too. Regarding pay cuts, the Colorado minimum wage is going to drop. This was from, who's this from? I don't know what it's from. Colorado will become the first state to reduce its minimum wage because of a falling cost of living. The State Department of Labor and Employment in Colorado ordered the wage down to $7.24 from $7.28. That's lower than the federal minimum of $7.25. So most minimum wage workers will lose only 3 cents an hour. The UAW and Ford Motor has reached a tentative deal. The guy who runs UAW, Ron Gettelfinger, who I have had contact with when we worked for IE America Radio. That's Tom Hartman spent time with them. I spent time with them. Who else? Who else? Peter Werby, Peter B. Collins. Anybody else? I think I was the only one getting paid at the time. Werby got paid? Okay. But then they fired him. Eventually, they fired me because they got rid of the entire network, the United Auto Workers on that network. A Gettelfinger could not figure out the value of a network owned by a labor union. That's a whole different story. But I don't like Gettelfinger. Gettelfinger has traded away hard-fought wage concession after hard-fought wage concession from the unions. And now, well, I'll tell you about it when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. If you and me go hear me rock and roll, then they play all night long. We'll dance all night long. But you just want to sit and listen to radio. You just want to sit and listen to radio. You just want to sit and listen to This portion of the Mike Malloy program is brought to you by It's Up to Us Alone, featuring Ed Asner. Go to usalone.com for information on where to hear the debut of this dramatic new radio play in your area. Fly into the sun. I'd break up into a million pieces and fly into the sun. It's about 22 past the hour. So the United Auto Workers, under the wobbly hand of Ron Gettelfinger, their president, is asking now 41,000 members who work at the Ford Motor Company to approve a deal that gives Ford Motor Company the same concessions that General Motors and Chrysler's have already received. Now remember, General Motors and Chrysler are both bankrupt, but not Ford. The deal was announced yesterday by Ford and the union, and it contains, are you ready? A 6-year freeze on wages. for newly hired workers. It combines some job classifications, which means eliminates jobs, and it limits the union's ability to strike. In return, the workers will get a $1,000 bonus next year. $1,000 bonus next year if you just agree to this, boys and girls. Oh, and Ford will make future product commitments at 5 assembly plants.
Oh, we promise that we'll be making cars at these 5 assembly plants over there in the future. Yes, we do.
How do you do that? The UAW sat down with the leaders of these various union locals in Detroit yesterday, and they voted almost unanimously to recommend the deal to their members. So says Ron Gettelfinger, the union's president. Gettelfinger urged union members to approve the deal, even though Ford is in a better position than GM and Chrysler. And Ford has not had to file for bankruptcy protection as those two companies did. You see? See how this works? Gettelfinger said in a statement, quote, Ford has twice as much debt on their balance sheet as GM. We want Ford to be successful. We want them to have a profitable quarter, and we want them to gain market share. That is job security for us. Ford executives have said more concessions from the union are needed, so that they, Ford Motor Company, doesn't become disadvantaged against its domestic rivals. Disadvantaged. What does that, mean? It means something. I just don't know what it means. Gettelfinger says he expects union members to ratify this pile of stinking cow dung within the next few weeks. Yes, he does. Now, according to the New York Times, this deal could be somewhat of a tough sell to Ford's rank-and-file workers. Ford is the only Detroit automaker to report any profits this year. And some UAW members, I like that word, some. And some UAW members are frustrated that they already made concessions in the contract they approved in 2007. And in a March deal this year that modified even that. But you know what? Union leaders are counting on that $1,000 bonus payable next March and the commitments from Ford Motor to continue making cars to overcome whatever opposition exists in the rank and file. Jesus, God Almighty. The deal with Ford also prohibits the UAW from going on strike over demands for increased wages or benefits. They're signing away the only collective bargaining tool that a union has when the bosses become intransigent or will not deal, and that is strike. So Ron Gettelfinger has decided to say to his union workers, you keep paying your dues, but we are going to absolutely bend you over and jam it in your back. No more strikes, boys. 6-year wage freeze for incoming new union members. Now, understand that there's already a 2-tier system. Most old-time union union workers, UAW, make about $25 an hour. They also get a benefits package too. But the actual on the floor wages they make is about $25 an hour. Do you know what the new hires make? The new guys coming in, $12, $12.50, $13. So anyone who goes to work in the auto industry now, who's a union member, goes to work for Ford Motor and is a member of the UAW, are going to agree that for the next 6 years, they will accept what the company gives them. It doesn't make any difference how much profit the company makes. It doesn't make any difference about anything. No strikes. Don't say a word. Come in, work the goddamn line, eat your lunch, and go home. This is the new America. This does not belong to the worker anymore. This does not belong to the middle class anymore. There is no up-and-coming middle class any longer. This is all about maximizing corporate profits by the same companies who screwed everything up to begin with. So the American worker, goodbye, boys. We'll be right back.
It's Mike Malloy.
No, I'm not too pissed off. 25 before the hour. Now, do you want to hear something here that would just absolutely frost your hindquarters? Saudi Arabia wants the rest of the world to give it money. There's any drop in oil revenues because the planet, the various nations of the planet decide to cut back on the use of fossil fuels, namely oil, in order to save the planet from suffocating. Huh? According to the Times, Saudi Arabia is trying to enlist other oil-producing countries to support this idea. And here it is. If wealthy countries reduce their oil consumption to combat global warming, the wealthy companies should pay compensation to the oil producers. Yeah. Now, the Saudis pushed this position for years in earlier climate treaty negotiations, like in the 1992 attempt in Rio de Janeiro. This was brought up. You and I never heard about it. Well, maybe you did, but I didn't. They've not succeeded in doing this, but the efforts on the part of the Saudis have, according to the Times, delayed or disrupted discussions on how to get global climate change, if not under control, at least stable. So these negotiations on global climate change are scheduled for Copenhagen, in December. And the Saudis are gearing up again to take a hard line on this issue. The chief Saudi negotiator, a guy named Mohammed Al-Saban, described the position as a, quote, make or break, end quote, provision for the Saudis. He said in an email message, I guess to the Times, quote, assisting us as oil exporting countries in achieving economic diversification is very crucial for us through foreign direct investments, technology transfer, insurance, and funding. In other words, these rancid son of a bitches, these filthy goddamn maniacs in Saudi Arabia want us, among other so-called wealthy countries, hey, jerkwad, haven't you looked at the balance sheet of the United States lately? They want us to pay them if the revenues into their treasury, these sick son of a bitches, goes down. That's right. They view any attempt to reduce... I'm angry. Pardon my language, but I'm angry. They view any attempt to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by countries like ours as a menace to their economies. These crazy bastards, what are they going to breathe? Environmental advocates, the Times says, denounced the idea, saying the Saudi stance hampered progress to assist poor nations that are already suffering from the effect of climate change and that genuinely need financial assistance. A spokesman for the National Resources Defense Council said, quote, it is like the tobacco industry asking for compensation for lost revenues as a part of a settlement to address the health risks of smoking. The spokesman went on to say the worst of this racket is that they have held up progress on supporting adaptation of funding for the most vulnerable countries for years because of this demand. Now, end quote, how valid is their demand? Well, Saudi Arabia, of course, is dependent on oil exports. They don't do anything else. They just suck money from the rest of the world and then go spend it. When they were afraid that the Iraqis were going to attack their country, all the eligible males left Saudi Arabia and hid while the Americans and our allies invaded Iraq the first time, the Gulf War, and kicked the Iraqis all the way back to Baghdad, kicked them out of Kuwait, and got them off the Saudi border. The Saudis, they are Sunnis to begin with, which means they are deathly enemies of the Iraqis, the Iranians, any place where there are Shia Muslims. The Sunnis are, I don't know how to describe it. It's like, I guess, Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland years ago, but that's not even making it as intense as it really is. But oil exports account for probably all of that filthy government's budget. Last year, when prices peaked, the Saudi oil revenue swelled by 37% to almost $300 billion. That's according to Jadwa Investment, a Saudi bank. That was more than four times what they made in 2002. At one point in 2008, remember the average gasoline price here in the States went up above $4 a gallon? Remember that? Saudi exports are expected to drop to $115 billion this year. Oh, poor babies! After oil prices fell, American gasoline prices now are hovering around $2.50 a gallon. A recent study by the International Energy Agency, which advises industrialized nations, found that the cumulative revenue of the OPEC countries would drop by 16% from 2008 to 2030 if the world agreed to slash emissions, as opposed to the projection if there were no treaty. 16%. Oh, however, with oil projected to average $100 a barrel. Remember, Goldman Sachs just said it's going to be $85 a barrel by the end of, what did Prairie 2 say, by the end of 2010 or the end of this year, whatever. With oil projected to average $100 a barrel, the Energy Agency estimates that the OPEC members would still earn $23 trillion over the same period from 2008, which was last year, to 2030. $23 trillion. And these miserable sons of bitches, and remember, please keep in mind, these are the Bush crime family's business partners. It also is the country that provided 15 of the 19 bombers who came to this country to murder 3,000 people, if you believe the official story. And that part of it, I pretty much believe. They are... should be the sworn enemies of the United States. They should be the sworn enemies of just about any industrialized country that has to depend on these rancid bastards for their livelihood. The OPEC countries can, and I'm not talking necessarily about other OPEC countries. I'm talking about the ones in the Middle East. Frankly, I hate them. I really do. I don't know why I hate them, but I just hate them. I guess because they are cowardly parasites. They don't do anything. They don't even dig their own oil out of the ground. They have other countries come and do that. And they are wealthy beyond belief as a factor of geography, not as a factor of all their efforts to build wealth. No, they haven't done that. They just happen to squat where the oil happens to be. When do you suppose we're ever going to wise up to this game? And... you know, every time there's an election for any office, probably most often the presidency, you always hear the candidates talk about, well, I want to free us from dependence on foreign oil. And then nothing happens. Nothing happens. And you know why? Because they say, well, the environmentalists won't let us dig in Tampa Bay or drill in Tampa Bay. They won't let us drill right off the coast of San Diego. We can't put oil derricks in San Francisco Bay. That's the reason. They won't let us into the Alaskan Wildlife Refuge. Yeah, it's their fault. No, That's not the answer at all. The answer is new technology. You know, clean, green technology. We have a nuclear reactor that sits 93 million miles from the Earth and delivers enough power, what, every hour? Or is it every day? Or is it every minute to run every goddamn appliance on the face of the Earth endlessly? And there it sits out there, beaming out all this energy. No, no, we're not interested. We're not interested in that. No, 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 no. Of course, that's free. It's endless insofar as we're concerned. Oh, sure, eventually that nuclear furnace is going to explode, but not for a long time, truth seeker. So we continue to do this. Just like we continue to make plans to send more soldiers to Afghanistan, where we will be defeated. We will be defeated mercilessly. What would you do if an invader came to your country? I'm not talking to you right-wingers. Listen to something else, because you are a bunch of goddamn cowards. But if you're a normal American, what would you do if an invader came here? You know, and started killing your children and your wedding parties and your town meetings, dropping bombs from drone aircraft that were operated from thousands of miles away, and treated you like nothing, like you were a rock or some kind of a plant embedded in the desert, you know. What would you do when you eventually got your hands on these sons of bitches? You know, like maybe a patrol of these people came through your neighborhood. 8 or 10 of them. What would you do? Well, if you're not a Republican now, they are cowardly pissants. But if you're a normal American, you would surround them. And even though you would take casualties, you would capture them. And then you would make them die the most horrible way you could imagine, because they have been burning our children to death. They've been bombing everything that we have. They've been trying to force their system on us. Wouldn't you? Okay, so what do you suppose is going to happen to Americans?
Wait forever for the young Marine. Now I believe to be here is right.
Progressive Talk. It's Mike Malloy.
It's 10 before the hour. Yeah, I realize I just had a rather a hideous display of what many people say is irrational hatred for our Saudi brothers, right? Because it's our fault. I mean, all they're doing is what capitalists always do, charging what the traffic will bear and sitting back on their well-padded haunches while, you know, while we continue to send them money. They haven't come over here and said, buy oil. We've gone over there and said, sell us oil. So, you know, I realize it's irrational. It's misdirected. I'm angry, I guess, that 50 or 60 years of U.S. policy that has got us to this point. You know what I'm saying? So I realize how stupid that rant sounded. I really do. You know, no one has ever come up to me and said, "Hey, listen, you are really a calm, balanced radio talk show host." I'm not. This is from Mr. Mitch. He writes, "Mike, sitting here and listening to the show, I heard the latest about no photos of any of our war dead. I see it as one more attempt to keep the truth of war from the American people. Of course, none of our servicemen and women are dying in the illegal wars in Iraq and Afghanistan because there are no pictures of the dead. Now, we'll show the dead when they're not Americans, but those sons of bitches don't want us to see our dead. I'm the Vietnam vet, and I think we need to show the cost of war to this country, both in dollars and lives, and quit trying to bury our heads in the sand, but I know that's not going to happen. Our government is once again going to try to make the war a clean and neat event by restricting news coverage of the whole dirty thing. You must take a stand and refuse to allow them to brush it under the rug. I, along with many of your listeners, are behind you and want and need the truth to be voiced. You're our voice, and we cannot allow the American people to go about their normal lives and not have to see the costs placed upon the service members because the government wants to keep a clean war. Thanks for listening to my rant, Vietnam Vet, 1968. I'm not anyone's voice. I'm just my own. You might happen to agree with it, Mr. Mitch, but you are your voice. I'm just someone who sits here 3 hours a night and goes into sometimes irrational rants about the Saudis, or read an open letter from someone who has more experience about this sort of thing in his finger than our president has in his entire body about don't go into Afghanistan. Don't do it. Don't do it. We have talked with Frank Schaefer on this program. We also have talked with Larissa Alexandrovna, who is one of the editors at rawstory.com. She has interviewed him. And you really need to read this. Go to rawstory.com. The full interview is there. But what Larissa has written is about, you know, Frank Schaefer. We've talked about this. We've had him on the air. He's an outspoken critic of the Christian evangelical right. He sees this phony-ass end times movement as anti-Semitic. He fears that a right-wing terrorist might assassinate the President of the United States. In an interview with Raw Story, Frank Schaefer, by the way, he's got a new book coming out this month called Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism. Oops. Anyway, Schaefer discusses his concerns about the radicalization of the Christian right and the increasingly violent rhetoric. Schaefer said, quote, since President Obama took office, I felt like the lonely, maybe crazy, proverbial canary in the coal mine. As a former right-wing leader who many years ago came to my senses and began to try to undo the harm the movement of religious extremism I helped build has done, I've been telling the media that we're facing a dangerous time in our history. A fringe element seems it believes it has a license to incite threatening behavior in the name of God. He goes on to say the best-selling status of the Left Behind novels proves that, not unlike Islamist terrorists who behead their enemies, many evangelical fundamentalist readers relish the prospect of God doing lots of messy killing for them as they watch in comfort from on high. They want revenge on all people not like them forever. He says he's worried that the president could be assassinated or that extremists might launch another Murrah building, federal building type bombing. Schaefer told Raw Story, quote, sadly, that line from The Godfather sticks in my brain about the fact that anyone can be killed. He says the scary thing is that there are a number of pastors on record as saying they are praying for the president's death. Can you imagine what some gun-toting paranoid who hears that in a sermon is thinking it might do? And to them, the fact that the world likes this black man is reason enough to hate him. You wait, Frank says. The reaction to Obama winning the Nobel Prize will be entirely negative from the religious right. Yeah, they're calling him the Antichrist now. The Antichrist, I guess, somewhere in the Bible, it says, will win the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize. I don't know. Anyway, go to rawstory.com and read the interview. It's I read it this afternoon. Larissa Alexandrovna interviews Frank Schaefer. And while it might be interesting, it's interesting in the same way watching, eight or ten spiders attacking a baby bird would be interesting. You know, it's that kind of interesting. It's hideous, hideously interesting. All right, we'll be back after the break. When we come back, if you like, we will take some calls here momentarily. I have two more quick things from our military affairs correspondent, Sharon Gordy. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. 6 and a half past the hour. This is the Malloy program. I have a trick question for you. Why do you know what happened in Washington D.C. last Sunday? Between 160 and 200,000 people marched. How much coverage of that did you see? Right? You let 300 teabaggers get together for one of their little juvenile hate fests, and Jesus Christ, the network cameras are all over the place. 160,000 gay folk and their supporters marched. Have you seen the pictures? Holy jumping Jesus. I mean, there they all are. And how much coverage did you see? Now, I was out of town Sunday. Were we gone Sunday? Yeah, we were gone Sunday. We were up in the mountains. Maybe there was lots of coverage. But I don't think so. Where's all the discussion about the issues, the way they do these goddamn rancid teabaggers or these birthers? Huh? Where's Wolf Blitzer talking about this? Where is, what's his name? Sanchez on CNN. Where are all the people talking about? Where's Joe? What's his name in the morning? Morning Joe. Joe Scarborough. Where's everybody talking about 200,000 queers and their family members and their supporters getting together in D.C. demanding human rights? Where? Where's the discussion? I haven't heard a thing. Have you? Jesus God. Way to go, American media, you filthy bastards. Way to go. You get 1,000 teabaggers together and it's like the second coming of their frizzed up, crazed messiah, right? But you let 150, 200, pick a number. I don't give a damn. Pick a number. 200,000 people. Quarter of a million? Okay, that's a good number. Quarter of a million queers get together to demand human rights. And the media, what? What happened? Where? Oh, really? Is that the thing Obama spoke at? No, that was the night before, you dumbasses. Oh, really? Was there something? Oh, a march? I do, really. But you know what does get a little coverage, at least on this program? Now, I'm going to give you a phone number and a name after I do this program, or after I do this little bit here. So have something ready to write, because you might want to call this guy. He's the principal of a high school, Geneva High School in Geneva, Illinois. This is from the Sun-Times in Chicago. A Geneva High School teacher is being accused of making anti-gay and racist comments in his classroom. Dave Burke is the teacher's name. He teaches consumer education. And last week, October 5th, he gave a lecture on tax money going to the National Endowment for the Arts. Well, you can tell right away where this crazy son of a bitch is, right? Tax money going to National Endowment for the Arts. God have mercy. But you know how he phrased it? According to students, he said this. How would you feel about your tax dollars going to pay some black fag in New York to take pictures of other black fags? End quote. His attorney said Monday that the attorney, was not personally aware of the terms Burke used to his classes, but that Mr. Burke apologizes for any offense. The attorney says, Mr. Burke is cooperating fully with both the principal, the dean of students, and the school board. Mr. Burke's biggest problem is he does not want to intentionally offend anybody, and if he did, he apologizes. if he did... How'd you feel about your tax dollars going to pay some black fag in New York to take pictures of other black fags? Ooh, nothing wrong with that statement, right, Mr. Lawyer? Oh, I'm sure Mr. Burke had no intention of offending anybody with that statement. No, if anybody was offended, oh, he's so sorry. The lawyer said the teacher will abide by any punishment the school district picks. The lawyer said, we have no intention of fighting anything. One of the students in the class who happens to be gay said, If he wants to talk about a poor place to put our tax dollars, I think his salary is a poor place to put our tax dollars. The student said, and several other students in various classes said Burke repeated the same phrase in all his classes. The student, who's 17, said, quote, he's free to feel any way he wants, but with him being in a position of influence like that over children, I don't think he should be using that position to make statements like that, end quote. School board member Matt Henry said the students' allegations might come up during tonight's board meeting. That was last night. But the board's plan is to leave the issue to Craig Collins, the assistant superintendent for personnel services. The school board member, Matt Henry, said, we heard about it, and pretty much it's a personnel issue. I understand the principal handled it. All right, here's the principal's name and his phone number. You want to maybe call the school and just say, hey, listen, is that the way to talk to our students? The principal's name is Tom Rogers. And the phone number, if you want to call, is 630-463-3800. That's according to their website. It's the Geneva High School in Geneva, Illinois. If you want to go to the website, go ahead. Tom Rogers, though, is the principal, 630-463-3800. The name and number and everything is right there. How'd you feel about your tax dollars going to pay some black fag in New York to take pictures of other black fags? Huh? National Endowment for the Arts, my ass! Sounds like a great teacher, doesn't he? Huh? I wonder if our education correspondent is listening tonight, Kay. Well, if not, she'll probably do the podcast tomorrow. Good God. And you think all the crazy people are in the South? Is Geneva in southern Illinois? Probably. How would you like some black fag in New York using your tax dollars to take pictures of other black fags? Well, my, my, my. Our military affairs correspondent sent me a couple of things real quick here. The Veterans Affairs Department said yesterday it plans to make it easier for Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange, who suffer from certain medical conditions, to qualify for VA benefits. 40 years. That's all it's taken these bastards. 40 years. 40 years. The conditions that will allow Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange to qualify for benefits are B-cell leukemia, Parkinson's disease, ischemic heart disease. The veterans with those conditions under the VA's proposal would have presumptive status, which would make it easier to obtain benefits. The Veterans Affairs Secretary, Eric Shinseki, who is a former general who was in command in Iraq until he was fired by George W. Bush, General Shinseki said that made the decision based on findings in a study by the Institute of Medicine. It would bring to 15 the number of medical conditions that have presumptive status in connection to Agent Orange exposure. The VA estimates that about 200,000 Vietnam veterans might seek benefits under this proposed change in policy. The VA estimates that between January 1965 and April 1970, more than 2 million U.S. military personnel were potentially exposed to Agent Orange as it was used to defoliate the whole goddamn country. Now, who's compensating the Vietnamese? B-cell leukemias, Parkinson's disease, ischemic heart disease. Is that how you say it, Kathy? Ischemic, I-S-C-H-E-M-I-C, ischemic heart disease. And there's one more when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Flying monkey free fun and frivolity with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. In addition to General Shinseki making this decision to make it easier for Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange who suffer from B-cell leukemias or Parkinson's or ischemic heart disease to get benefits, he also has announced an agreement with local homeless providers in Sepulveda, California, which will ensure that veterans can occupy 150 apartments created on the campus of the local Department of Veterans Affairs healthcare facility. Homeless veterans. Homeless veterans. Now, homeless veterans to Dick Cheney and George Bush didn't exist. And when they did exist, they didn't give a goddamn. Are you kidding me? Homeless veterans? And as far as increased benefits for, or expanded benefits, expanded categories eligible for benefits were concerned, Agent Orange, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney didn't give a goddamn. Why should they? Didn't affect them. Nor did Rumsfeld. Nor did any of these swine. So Shinseki is trying. In addition, the female soldiers and others who serve behind front lines they weren't on the immediate front lines of combat, and they've had a hard time trying to prove that their combat experience resulted in post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's going to change. Veteran Affairs Department has proposed reducing the paperwork required for veterans to show their experience caused combat-related stress. Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat of Washington, called it a significant shift in policy. She says, quote, "Before and for a long time, I've been fighting many times over for the VA not to discourage people from saying they have PTSD. We have many cases where veterans are told it's all in your head." Well, yeah. Patty Murray, good for her. But I don't know if she understands. I'm sure she does understand the irony of what she said. Where else does post-traumatic stress disorder reside? I'm not busting Patty Murray. I'm busting the freakish previous Veterans Administration chain of command that would tell soldiers and Marines, PTSD, well, that's all in your head. Well, no kidding, you halfwits. So, and we're going to have so many more veterans who are going to be suffering. That report I shared with you last night about all the veterans now that are sick and getting cancer from being exposed to depleted uranium weaponry. And when shells, artillery shells that are made of depleted uranium, when they explode and get into the environment like dust in Iraq, and we have exploded, counting the first Iraq invasion and slaughter, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of these depleted uranium-encased shells, bullets, all bombs. So there's no telling. It's not even news anymore. After the invasion back in 1993, the first Gulf War, when within two or three years after that, hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of Iraqi children were being born with hideous birth defects and dying shortly after being born. And various global health organizations started reporting on this. Spontaneous abortions up 1,000%, then 10,000%. children being born hideously deformed with hideous diseases and birth defects. And then people started dying of cancers that were unknown in Iraq prior to our bombing and using depleted uranium. And then we did it to them again in 2003. 10 years later, hey, let's go back and make them even sicker. Well, as was in Vietnam with Agent Orange, now here we are with depleted uranium, and American soldiers are starting to die. Young American soldiers are now starting to develop hideous cancers and die. What sort of weaponry do you suppose we're going to use and have been using in Afghanistan? Do you think there has been some great revelation in the military-industrial complex to stop using depleted uranium? Got to put that crap somewhere, right? It's a very hard substance. It's very good in penetrating tanks and hivey holes. So has there been an effort to end the use of depleted uranium? Not that I've heard about. Of course, I don't hear about much. I didn't hear anything about 250,000 gay folk gathering in Washington, D.C. last Sunday. So, you know, who knows? Maybe, and I know that happened, so maybe we have oh, please, Mike, come on. We're talking about something entirely different. We just keep doing it, don't we? I wonder when this is going to stop. Does it take, do we have to become, I don't know, do we have to become, I guess we do, a foreign military power like Holland or France or Great Britain, huh?
There is a season, turn, and a time to every purpose.
Arm yourself with the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
It's come through a hole in the air from those nets in Tiananmen Square.
It's 25 before the hour, as promised. Let's do some phone calls here. Mark is in San Francisco listening on Green 960. Hey, Mark.
Mike, how you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good, sir. You know, the war is not in Afghanistan. The war is not in Iraq. The war is here. The war on the middle class for 30 years has been going on, Mike. And our country's being devastated. I mean, they talk about health care. We have a crisis. So many people have lost their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
The tax loopholes for corporate America. I mean, we're losing our tax revenue. I mean, this is where the war is, Mike. This is the war we got to fight.
How would you propose doing that?
Well, we need our politicians to understand we don't want any more dead soldiers. We don't want to spend any more money. I mean,
okay, I agree with
you. Want a revolution, then maybe that's what we got to do, Mike. I don't know what it's going to take. Really don't. We had an election with a mandate to change, and we were hoping that Barack Obama would address the problems of the middle class and the problems that Reagan started and Bush took to the max. And that's what we voted for. We voted with a mandate for change. We don't care what the Republicans want in the health care. The hell with them.
Mm-hmm.
Our country's we're in dire straits. The city of San Francisco is $9 million in the hole. We're going to hell in a handbasket here. And they're worried about Afghanistan. We can't afford to go there anymore, Mike.
Right.
This is where the war is.
No, Mark, I agree with you 100%. And I'm looking for solutions desperately. I don't see any. Do you? When I ask you that, that's not a challenge. I'm looking for information. I'm desperate, man. I am absolutely desperate. I want to know, what are we supposed to do?
Mike, the only thing left, and I had a saying when I ran the union, and a company brought in union busters. I had a saying, I told them, if we go down, we're taking you with us. And we're getting to the point, Mike, where that's where we're at. If this government doesn't start addressing the issues of middle-class America and start fighting on our behalf. We're losing our revenue because we're losing our jobs. We can't fund the government anymore because they've gone to corporate America so much. I guess that's the message. If they keep going down this road, you know, what else are we going to do to make them understand? Is to take them down with us. What's left?
Well, Mark, I hear you. I don't disagree with what you've said. I thank you for calling in. I hear your frustration, man. I feel the same thing. In a lot of instances, when empire ends, the country that sought, developed, and maintained the empire until it collapsed, that country doesn't disappear. It just radically changes in terms of its global influence. You can look at all the European countries that at various times, I mean, Belgium, for God's sake, at one time was a global empire. Holland was, in addition to France and Spain and Great Britain, and when those empires eventually collapsed, it wasn't because necessarily there was some sort of wild internal revolution, and it didn't happen that way, not in modern times. It just collapsed because it could no longer sustain itself, and because liberation movements around the country said, no, get the hell out of our country. And, you know, once the casualties become unsustainable, then the invader, the occupier, the imperialist nation wakes up. It happened to the Soviet Union this time, and it was reduced down to 125 million people, 130 million people with an average life expectancy now of what? It's still in the 50s, isn't it? 56, 57 years old. If you're born in Russia right now, that's the average life expectancy. I realize those are trick figures. Some people in Russia still live to be 110, but you know what I'm saying. So maybe the answer is not, I don't know how it's going to play out in this country. It is going to end. Because it can't, we can't continue. It's not going to end because, I say it or you say it or Howard Zinn says it or somebody else says it. That's not why it's going to end. It's going to end it being what we're involved in now. It's going to end because it can no longer sustain itself. It just can't, just like you just pointed out. The weird part is the reason this craziness has not stopped is because the majority of Americans are not aware of it and not aware of the craziness. If 200 million Americans woke up tomorrow morning and really completely understood, like you do, like I think I do, where we are, that would be it. That awareness, that collective awareness, it would just be an, oh my God, and it would stop immediately. But don't forget where we live. We live in a country that makes denial a religion. Orion is calling from Pullman, Washington. Is that right?
Yes. How are you, Mike?
I'm fine, Orion.
Good. Hey, I was wanting to comment on the things you were talking about as far as the march that was in D.C. last weekend.
Uh-huh.
Well, and you were saying, you know, well, where the hell was the mainstream media on that versus all the covers that the teabaggers got, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it has to do with the fact, and this is kind of an underlying theme I'm seeing in a lot of things that I've been frustrated with recently, is that the media latches on to things that are, you know, sensational. And
well, wait. A quarter of a million queers marching through D.C. with their family and friends and kids and aunties and grandmas and grandpas and banners and flags and people cheering and even Lady Gaga giving a great speech and all this stuff. That's not exciting?
I'm on your side on this one, Mike.
Right. I understand that. I'm just saying, how could television not see that as exciting as hell? I mean, look at the Sunday. What happens on Sunday? Nothing. Here we have a quarter of a million people demanding Civil rights in the United States of, by God, America. How did they miss it? I don't have any idea, Ryan. Do you?
I don't. I think a lot of it is the fact that, and I know you touch on this with some regularity on your show, but I think it's rooted in religion's hold on whatever social values, in quotation marks, I guess, that this country or some people in this country have. And it's really unfortunate that, you know, some people use their faith and their spiritual beliefs as a means of entitlement and feeling better than somebody because of their orientation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think if we were generally more accepting of things that I think are beyond people's control, like their sexual orientation, that this obviously wouldn't be an issue. But it's just very unfortunate that we can't, you know, people are so afraid of what they've been taught to be afraid of by their religion, which, as you and I think both agree, is one of the greatest propagators of fear
mm-hmm.
we have.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely, Orion. I agree. Thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. Thanks for your call. John is in Los Angeles listening on KTLK. Hey, John.
Hey. My apologies to your call screener, but you mentioned about underreported in things happening in mm-hmm. media, and I think that one of the underreported happenings was that Mr. Madison, who was arrested outside the G20 meeting
mm-hmm.
for twittering the location of the police.
Right, in Pittsburgh, right.
And whose house was searched for, and, you know, items taken and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes to the media,
mm-hmm.
Where, you know, it's all controlled by commercial interests.
Yeah, it is.
And they're only interested in what's good for them commercially, and that is the teabaggers that keep the Democratic progressive agenda down,
mm-hmm.
and not covering the progressive way of thinking with the the gay march.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand that. I do.
They don't make money when people stand up for themselves. They need slaves.
But the teabaggers and the birthers and the deathers, they're laughed at. I mean, look, huh? I worked. They're laughed at. They're laughed at inside the television newsrooms. They're laughed at inside the newspaper assignment editors' offices. I know. I worked in both newspapering and in television for CNN and working in news. And these kinds of events, like the birthers and the teabaggers, they're mocked. They're made fun of. And I don't get, you know, the people are just considered to be total asses, just complete dorks. And yet they're reported on. And I think we used to have a thing at CNN called the geek and freak factor. If something was real news, you reported it. This is back in the day. I mean, they don't do this anymore. I'm talking about in the early 80s. Real news reported. Human interest stories were reported. Those were called kickers. And then there was the geek and freak story. And they got coverage. And that's what the geek and freak stories have evolved into, are the teabaggers and the birthers and the deathers. But when you have a real story, like 250,000 gay folk and their friends marching in Washington, it's ignored. Before the hour, thanks to our technical advisor, Ben Birch, our military affairs correspondent, Sharon Gordy, economic affairs, Bruce Enberg, education, Kate Petrini, and the ethics advisors to the program, Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf. Kathy Bay is our engineer and also the executive producer. Michael's in New York City. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. You're my favorite talk show host, by the way.
Thanks.
You know, a lot of people have been talking about capitalism, socialism, et cetera. You've been talking about it a lot lately.
Yeah.
And you had a caller on just a few minutes ago who was talking about a war on the middle class.
Right, right.
Well, I mean, the war's over and the middle class is lost.
Well, that's true. That's true.
And, you know, you were talking about how rotten capitalism is yesterday or the day before?
Yeah, many times. So yesterday, I think, was the last time. Yeah, it's a horrifying way to try to run an economy.
I agree with you 100%. The real question is, where do we go? People would say socialism. I would say that sounds good. The only problem is, how do we get there? I don't think there's a single socialist economy in the world. It depends on how you want to define it.
I always talk about democratic socialism. I'm not talking about totalitarian socialism.
Oh, I agree.
Right.
Democratic socialism,
to some degree, and I believe it should be a minimally invasive kind of socialism. The way I look at it, there are several key industries that need to be nationalized or socialized. I've said it before. Banking, energy, healthcare, transportation, and weapons production. All that has got to be socialized, if you will. And the reason for the weapons production, the goal is eliminating that altogether. So if it is part of a socialist structure, it can be eliminated. And then allow free enterprise in its real form to flourish in democratic socialism, where I've said it before, small businesses, factories, farms, that flourishes. There's no central. I'm not talking about central planning. I'm not talking about an economic system.
That sounds good to me.
Yeah.
I'd like a variety of different ideas.
Well, that's what democratic socialism is, kind of a mixed economy kind of idea is what I'm advocating. A lot of people say, well, you goddamn socialist. I'm not talking about, totalitarian, top-down, central planning, yada, yada.
Like totalitarian systems,
right.
Except maybe the people on top.
Right.
I know what it was like in the Soviet Union. I visited it when it still existed. And it was a strange place, and it was not socialism. It was not socialism.
No, it was fascism, purely and simply.
It was a type of totalitarianism that, in any case was not socialism.
Right.
It was bizarre. I think Sweden, Norway, Denmark, those countries come closest to socialism of any countries I can think of. Still, they're fundamentally capitalist countries. I think socialism has a lot to recommend it, and I agree that the industries that you suggested should be nationalized, and the interesting thing is when you talk about the banks, for example, or other investment financial services firms, for example, which are supposedly too big to fail, my point would be, well, then the government simply ought to liquidate them if they're insolvent, take them over, break them up into smaller parts, and then, if need be, reprivatize them. That's not very socialist.
Well, we did that before when we broke up the Standard Oil Trust. Back at the turn of the last century.
Yeah.
But it's back together. ExxonMobil is just the old Standard Oil Trust back together again.
It's true. That's the ultimate direction.
Right.
Well, even so, when you do that, of course, you still run the risk that it's going to go back in the same direction, which is why...
But I think that's because we did not write the necessary laws to prevent it from. It's like a science fiction movie where there's some kind of a blobby thing attacking and killing, and they blow it into a million pieces with an A bomb, and sure enough, it reconnects itself and continues to devour cities and farms and pigs and babies. We didn't put in place in this country the proper laws necessary to prevent it from happening. Again, and history repeats itself. First is farce, then is tragedy, and I think we're on the third go. We're on the second repeat, and we're staring at a tragedy. So I don't know.
I agree, and I'm very pessimistic about it. The real problem is, how do you get there? I mean, you know, and that's the question your caller was asking about, you know, the war on middle class. How do you get there?
Well,
we just vote for the right people?
Well, there is one, as long as we still have the power to vote, even though that's been horribly corrupted by these hellacious voting machines and proprietary programs that run the machines, if we can get the voting system back where you sit down with a piece of paper and check off the person you want, if we can get that back, then voting is a way. And it's through enlightened candidates, enlightened leadership. We don't have that now. We have slugs. We have people who are totally owned by corporate America, completely owned by corporate America, Democrats and Republicans. Enlightened leadership would get us out of this. I don't know where the enlightened leadership is. I don't know. I mean, I can sit here and spout this stuff every night, three hours a night, and I think to myself, you know, I'm not all that bright. Whatever knowledge I have is accumulated. It's stuff I've picked up and learned and yada yada. If I can talk about this stuff, if I can see the disaster staring at us and a way to end the disaster, why can't the people who are going to lead the country, why can't they? Oh, man. All right. Thanks, everybody. We're out of here. I'll see you tomorrow night. Okay. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.